This week in Washington, there's a pair of major events for moderators to host. This morning's discussion for the launch of STM Tech Trends 2015 is one. The other is the White House Correspondents' Annual Dinner on Saturday. I know where I'd rather be. How about you? On Saturday, the wit will be as sharp and pointed as needles. The president, who every day has to endure the slings and arrows of the press corps, will get his chance to return the favor for a single night. Who wants to see that when you have five members of the STM Future Lab committee to hear from? As for hosts, well, Stephen Colbert can eat my notebook. He's not taking this gig away from me. So let me, if I can, briefly introduce the committee of members who are joining me this morning. Moving from the far end, we have to welcome Jasper Simons. Jasper, welcome. Jasper Simons is the publisher of PsycINFO at the American Psychological Association. PsycINFO is the world's largest resource devoted to peer-reviewed literature in behavioral sciences and mental health. Before joining the American Psychological Association, Simons held senior management and publishing roles at companies such as Thomson Reuters, Elsevier, and Sage Publications. To his left is Jennifer Robinson. Jennifer, welcome. As Senior Director of Product Management, Jennifer Robinson is responsible for all electronic platforms at Walters Kluwer Medical Research. These include the institutional platforms for aggregated products, Ovid SP, Nursing at Ovid, as well as the journal hosting platform and journal apps. She has been with Walters Kluwer for over 13 years in several capacities covering institutionally sold content products as well as development initiatives for the Ovid platform. To her left is David Martinson, regular on these discussions. David, welcome. David holds a PhD degree in physical chemistry from the University of Minnesota and has been at the American Chemical Society, ACS, for 25 years, working in various capacities in the publication division and in IT. He's currently chair of the Committee for Printed on Electronic Publications of the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry and co-chair of the NISO NFACE Supplemental Journal Materials Technical Working Group. To his left is Jerry Grenier. Jerry, welcome. Jerry is currently Director of Publishing Technologies for the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, IEEE, leads a 40-person electronic publishing team responsible for development and operation of IEEE Explore, their digital library of over 3 million journal articles, papers, and standards in electrical engineering and computer science. And finally, joining them as well is Professor Cassidy Sugimoto. Again, welcome. As we've heard, she's assistant professor in the School of Information and Computing at Indiana University, Bloomington, and a prolific author on new metrics in scholarly assessment. And at the risk of making you continue your keynote here, because it was so engaging, Professor Sugimoto, I want to compliment, first of all, the enormity of the task that you face. And I was impressed with this notion of the public identity of researchers. It's something that we address here in the Tech Trends category of reputation management, and in particular the way that this very public identity is bringing the ivory tower, if not down, at least down to size. Is that how you see it?
That's a great question. I think that scholars are perhaps more vulnerable in this visibility, but this visibility also garners some reputation. So it's a mixed bag, right? You can at once be more visible, have your work read widely and cited by multiple people, but if you make the simplest of mistakes, that can also tear you down quite easily. So in sort of bringing it down to size, there's an opportunity to make mistakes in social media, and that can have fairly severe repercussions for your academic livelihood.
Right, and it's interesting to me that there is this kind of zeitgeist of social media that, as you pointed out, is at odds with science as we understand it. Science is precise, and social media is messy.
It is messy, and I think that there's a greater comfort level with that messiness. When I first started, I was terrified to write my first tweet because I didn't want to have a spelling mistake in it, right? I wanted it to be perfect and precise. I wanted it to be at the quality that I would expect of my scientific publications. But that's not how social media works, right? People are ready to put something out, have a spelling mistake, be comfortable with that error. And I think that they're also feeling that comfort level with their scientific publications, their readiness to put a preprint online before it's gone through peer review, before it's gone through the sort of quality mechanisms of publishing, indicates that they're okay with the messiness inherent in that media, and perhaps they're less less likely to look for sources that provide that extra layer of quality, because right. content is important and speed is important.
Right. Well, perhaps messiness is not quite the right word for all of that. I'm looking at the diagram here and thinking that the way the internet works is it makes everything transparent. We understand how things work in ways that we did not before, because they were inside black boxes, essentially. It's rather like, as Afka said, there's this watch. It tells us time. We don't think about all the gears inside. What that diagram is telling us is that there's a tremendous interlocking system at work here. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, finally, whether you feel that this is all good for science, what we're seeing, this kind of light that has been shed. It's certainly having an impact on researchers' careers. Just briefly, how good is all of this for science?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that transparency aspect is the best part of it, right? And we've had numerous times where people have identified mistakes in science because it was made transparent, made visible earlier on. It also, when we collect data, such as the gender data that I showed you, making visible disparities is also important for the scientific workforce and for science. So there are many benefits to transparency, but there are also some goal displacement activities that happen when you make something transparent.
Yeah, we'll talk about more of that in just a moment, but I want to turn to Jennifer Robinson at Wolters Kluwer and look at that first element of our chart here, data as first-class research object. And maybe, Jennifer, it's because we're here in Washington. I think of data becoming a first-class research object. I think about what it means to be, in the past, for example, a second-class citizen. Women were second-class citizens. African-Americans were second-class citizens. In civil rights and so forth, and suffrage, they became first-class citizens. Is that an appropriate analogy for data? Has it been a second-class citizen in the past, do you feel?
I do think that it's emerging as an object of importance independent of the article itself. I know at Wolters Kluwer we're monitoring medical trends and funder mandates very closely to look at the future of data from a publishing perspective. One of the things that we're doing behind the scenes is re-architecting our entire content ingestion to accommodate different types of content outside of text and article, and to really facilitate data and what does that mean. And in the medical space in particular, it's really unknown how it's going to emerge and whether it's going to be a unified thing or whether it's going to take its own character in independent specialties.
Right. And medicine, of course, covers a wide range of fields, and some are leading the charge on this. Tell us which ones particularly.
So I think what we're finding is that there aren't a lot of standards. Cassidy mentioned this earlier. There aren't a lot of standards. And in medicine, we have this added challenge of de-anonymizing or anonymizing patient information, and there aren't a lot of players that do that in a consistent fashion. So it's a real challenge, and what I sense is going to happen is individual specialties will take the lead in their own communities at building the standards around the data, and then we'll have to accommodate that in specific specialties. So specialties, I think, that have more sort of biologic background or more research heavy will emerge as leaders in the data front because of the needs around that.
Right. And when it comes to data in medicine, the subject of the research, it's not lab rats, it's human beings. And that really adds a special concern, I suppose, because really it's about whose data is it. So the researchers are conducting this research, but is it their data?
So it's about making the data useful outside of the individual research. So it's about taking the data that is tied with one study and really maximizing the use for the research community around that. The way we see data emerging is really outside of the individual study at hand to really open up opportunities to share and reuse data in a meaningful way for future studies or derivative studies. So in medicine, in particular, one of the key sort of outcomes is to take a lot of different clinical studies and synthesize and come up with the evidence to support a specific therapeutic intervention, and to be able to sort of use the data to help do that in the first place is critical.
Right. And Jesper Simons at APA, I know you've got some concerns about data. Do you recognize first that it is a first-class citizen, finally, this is something that's been a long time coming? Is that how you would see it?
I'm not sure if it's a... I think the distinction between first-class or second-class, I think, is more different stages of development in the publishing effort. I think that currently technical capabilities are there to share data, to host and store data. The cost of storage are going down, and there's more pressure for transparency. I think those are really the drivers for making the data available. And to Jennifer's point, using it as an opportunity for building further research, I mean, that's where the greatest sort of implications and opportunities are. I think in medical, as in the behavioral sciences, there are complications with human subjects in those data sets. For all of you sort of looking for these trends and what to do with them and how to interpret them, I think there could be guideposts in the way that the members of the Future Lab Committee have looked at this, and I think in the model that you have in front of you on your tables, there are also sort of pressure points that are important to look at as you sort of venture to address these issues. And one thing that I would like to share that the APA has done with a new journal, open access journal, the Archives of Scientific Psychology, to address this particular point about not just, well, we can make the data available, but do we want to make the data available? What are the implications or the downsides of making that available? And we actually have a review process, so you can, the data for this journal, the Archives of Scientific Psychology, are hosted on the ICPSR, the University of Michigan's repository that Professor Borgman talked about earlier this week. And you can request to use that data for further study, but we internally review that request, document that, and put some constraints around the use of that for proper attribute, with around proper attribution, etc. So I think there are middle grounds or different ways of addressing this. It doesn't have to be either entirely open or entirely restricted. There are methods that we can put in place to allow for this further building on data as a component of the scholarly efforts that follow. And minimizing some of the undue impacts of either on the subject matter or the original author's intent.
Right, and it seems to me then if we're going to place data as a first-class research object, there's a responsibility that publishers have to treat it in the same way you've treated the other immediately obvious first-class element, which is text. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's they're great opportunities, and I think I'm personally most excited about the advancing the reproducibility of the scholarly efforts, and I think that we have to be just thoughtful in how we do it, as we've done it with other content, and I think we're just starting to this, and hopefully this pointing this out as a trend for at the STM conference today. Puts further emphasis on so the consensus of many of the publishers that are participating in this conversation that there's more work to be done, but we're clearly heading in the direction of making this more valuable for the community.
Right. And David Martinson at ACS, to the point that Jasper made about treating it properly and sort of opening it up possibly to review, is data collection contributing to knowledge? Is that a certainty?
I would say, to hearken back to your initial introduction on the suffrage movement and civil rights, there was a sense in which those movements codified the equality, the first-class citizenship of various groups in law, but it took a while before, and some would argue that it still hasn't been fully achieved, that is evident in our society. There's still some distance to go. So I think if we declare data as a first-class object, it may still be a long time before the community accepts that, regardless of what we as publishers do. And it may be that different communities treat data and the citability of data, the treatment of data as a first-class object compared to the article. And one question that I think about often is, at what point does data actually become a scholarly object? And so, for example, in chemistry, I could be in a lab and I get some samples from somebody and I stick them in the instrument, press a button, and out comes the result in digital format, and I send it off to someone else for interpretation. Well, I've certainly contributed to the scholarship, but is that the same as the person who takes that data and comes up with some new theory about what's going on with those particular molecules in that reaction? And I would say, the way I phrased the question, probably not. But then I go back to Cassidy's, the thing that Cassidy pointed out in terms of the gender disparity in the research workflow, that it's the women who are predominantly doing that experimentation. And so how do we kind of justify or balance out the ways in which we treat these research objects and the way that we present them, the way that they get used and cited?
Well, if data becomes a first-class research object, does that challenge text, I wonder? Will there be a continuing need for text, in the future? Will data sort of surmount that?
Well, I guess what is the text all about? And in one sense, it's, as Chris Borgman discussed, the data are used as evidence to promote some hypothesis. And if you can, I don't think the data speak for themselves. The data need some voice to integrate them with other data to come up with the theories, the understanding, the analysis of why this particular data set, this particular reaction works this way. But having said that, I think one of the things that has been talked about in recent years is the minimum publishable unit. And does our research community have an obligation to publish a full report of results, a full text-based report of their research results, as opposed to slicing and dicing into the minimum publishable unit? And as we look at, say, data as a first-class object, it seems like we expand the possibilities there. So now I can have some text, which might be the results and conclusion. I can publish the data. That's another citable object. I could publish methods, protocols, as yet another research object. And so now I have, instead of my article with the data and the methods as part of one citable object, I've now expanded that into maybe four or five. I could have a video about the results. And so now I have a fourth component in there. So I can expand my publications quite extensively by adopting this, the additional research objects that could be out there.
Fascinating. And, you know, I'm going to take home the thought that data doesn't necessarily speak for itself. It's an interesting point. It seems a bit contradictory. As a journalist, we think the facts speak for themselves. But I certainly take your point that data itself does not speak for itself alone. And Jerry Grenier at IEEE, I want to bring you in to talk about the impact of all of this on the governance of publishing and what it means to make this happen in the real world. And so you can put in place infrastructures that enable the kinds of vision of the future that David Martinson was just talking about. But beyond the technology, there are other aspects of the business, the kind of the legal aspects, the social aspects. Talk a bit about the implications for that.
Sure. Let me begin by saying I think that, and just follow on what David said and to segue into what you the answer to the question that you asked me, an article in a scientific publication, I think, is really an advertisement. I don't mean to cheapen the article, but it really is an advertisement on the research, I think David was saying in so many words. And that the collection of elements that lead into that report together lead to this concept of reproducible research, right? And I think publishers can begin to do things like make it a requirement in guides for authors that in addition to the paper text being submitted, that the data also be submitted and the algorithms also be submitted, et cetera, and be available and accessible for researchers to attempt to reproduce that research. I think what might be a second coming, the OA movement, might be the RR movement, or the reproducibility of research movement that might come out of Washington here, the NSF or the DOE. I think it's a logical extension of the OA green movement, where the government agencies begin to say no longer you need to have a plan, which they mandated about eight years ago now, but it is required now for future funding of your research that you make that data accessible.
Okay. You know, to make data accessible, to enable the vision, as I was saying, that David Martinson has of all these various research components, there's a kind of a technology that's possible there. You can have that common environment. But it's not so easy, I suppose, to decide what's going to be shared, how things are going to be made available. Does that seem fair?
Well, I think we heard one presentation yesterday about the RMAP project, which I think leads us in that direction. It begins to tie together and make the relationships between the text and the different artifacts that support the research around that text. And further, Tim DeLore yesterday from RMAP described the process of the whole method of making assertions. So as people submit data to the RMAP graph, they assert the authenticity of that particular artifact.
Okay. And when it comes to the article in a hub-and-spoke model, that middle section of our diagram, and Jerry, again, we've sort of been leading to it with this discussion of data. From the perspective of the discussion the Future Lab Committee had in London in December, lots can be imagined, but how much is available in resources to make this happen?
How much is available in resources? Well, I think I think the hope lies in startup companies, and you know, we certainly try to do that at the STM meetings, is to introduce young startup companies who are coming up with new ideas to either host data, share data, run code. There are I don't know if people have heard of runmycode.org. Which is a great platform for a researcher to submit software code, and it runs in a very common environment, so that and they take care of setting that environment up. So I don't simply need to get code from David that he's run on his environment and hope that it runs on the environment that I have in my lab. So I think startups are. We should follow the work of startups and take them seriously, and perhaps the work that they do we absorb into our own cultures within our larger publishing operations.
Right. Well, Jennifer Robinson and Walters Kluwer there, to Jerry's point about working with startups, I know the approach that you've taken is a variety of forms of partnerships, particularly to enable this vision of the article to become a reality.
Yeah, from a technological perspective in particular, we always look at, sort of the buy versus build equation. And I think monitoring startups actually helps uncover how needs need to be approached. And then watching where startups may or may not be able to solve those needs is invaluable from our perspective. And then being able to utilize what startup companies have been able to do very agile, very flexibly, and sometimes is a little harder in larger publishing companies like our own. And so really trying to maximize the benefits that a startup brings to the table. From a technological perspective, we look for partners that are easily integratable with, obviously provide business models that are easy to work with and that allow us to still have control over our platforms and our technology solutions.
Right, and those startups, those third parties, are taking on tasks that had been publishers' work in the past.
Yeah, that's correct. And sometimes the startups have more ability to do that in a groundswell than a large publishing institution can do that. So capitalizing on some of the work that they've done is actually a much better solution for larger companies like our own.
Right. David Martinson, ACS, again, I'll turn us back to that vision you had of all the various elements that are possible to see as research elements. Have we reached a point where the notebook is going to become part of it? Have we got to a hoarding phase in publishing?
Hoarding.
I mean, are we trying to preserve everything? Are we trying to document and publish absolutely everything that happens?
Oh, so you're saying with the lab notebook?
Right. Yeah. From the video to the text to the data, ultimately down to the lab notebook.
Well, yeah. So I think certainly there has been a question about what is the data that should actually be published, and if you think of research data as a first class object, then independent, it could be dependent or independent of an article, which then gets you into the lab notebook environment. Some have advocated that negative results be published as well. And so not only the things that support my particular starting hypothesis, but those things that data that I collected that didn't support my hypothesis that eventually I just discarded because there's a couple ways of looking at that. I'm only selectively publishing the data that are in favor of my hypothesis, but just I found my hypothesis didn't work, so I just discarded that line of research and went on to something else. But that data could still be valuable. And so when you think about the lab notebook, how much of that lab notebook is usable? How much of that lab notebook could be the basis of someone's future research? And how many negative results does it take before you get a positive result, the one positive result that's publishable? And there was a quote that I was thinking of from Tolstoy, which says, happy families are all alike, and unhappy families are unhappy in their own unique way. And when you come to, say, negative results, there's a lot of reasons you could get negative results, but there may be only one way that all your parameters and variables are right to get that positive result. And so is it useful to publish all the failed attempts you had to try to get this reaction to work, for instance, in the chemistry world? Change your reagents, change your temperatures, change your stirring mechanisms, and you finally found the formula that works. Is all that stuff that didn't work of value, and should it be out there? Well, certainly, if it's a first-class object, I could get additional credit for that, and people could cite it. Another question might be, are those negative results reproducible? And if someone can't reproduce them, does that mean that they really got a positive result or I got a negative result? So it's a bunch of questions that come out of that that we need to think about.
Jasper Simons, I know you want to make a point. And, you know, I'm thinking about what I hear David say as a non-scientist. You know, it sounds like a world of clutter, and I wonder if you see it that way. And talk about something which is on this diagram here, which is the role of identifiers to help to, remove the ambiguity and to eliminate that clutter.
Yes, I'll do, but I want to go back to one other sort of different view on the trend of the article in the hub and spoke model. I really look at it more as a driven by competition among publishers on their main platforms, which are very well saturated across all the main institutions, and really to get that user engagement, move forward in that space to drive usage. And I think that when I look at the article in Hub and Spoke model, there's some fantastic examples. And we had the gentleman from the New England Journal of Medicine asking a question before. Well, what they've done on their platform to integrate different kinds of content is just phenomenal. And I think it's that I look at the article in Hub and Spoke model more as a way to further the engagement with our end users and our scholars to provide additional content sets. And I think they might be different. In some settings, the lab notebook might be very desirable complement to the article or the data set. But I think it's that engagement with end users that's really driving that technology trend, in my view. To your question about identifiers and the clutter, I think we need to carefully curate and manage that and add value to the experience of consuming information from the perspective of the scholar and look again at where it makes sense and not. I think the identifiers are essential. I mean, what Crossref and organizations like ORCID have done to prepare a foundation for the furthering of building those connections for all the platforms to utilize to allow for seamless moving between different components. It's enormous, and I think that we should build on that. And obviously, as mentioned yesterday, too, the complications in the area of data are profound to make that happen. I like the iceberg image from yesterday with the metadata and the content, sort of the data on the top and the metadata on the bottom is sort of the complexity that it comes with taking care of that. I think there's a lot more work to do, and we need to leverage these collaborations across publishers to find ways that we can build standards where they make sense.
Right, and when we look at the future, it's always about potential and promise. Mm-hmm. Again, as an outsider, I look at it, and even in the area of standards, there's potentially a clutter of standards as well.
There can be, yes. And I think, as with any good idea, as soon as it sees the light of day, it will be discussed and argued and built upon. And I don't think that you can set out to be and become the one standard from the beginning. I think you earn it over time.
Indeed. Jerry, please.
Yeah, just following on the question of identifiers, a new identifier that we might experience it could be a relationship identifier, right? So you have this... You have the text and the software code and data sets, and you've got these lines between them all, and drawing identifiers with an object model that describes the relationships between A and B and C and D and E and F. And I think, again, that's one of the goals of the RMAP project is to assign that unique identifier and preserve that identifier to illustrate those relationships or save data about those relationships.
Right. And Jennifer Robinson, so I saw you nodding vigorously at that point. It is a good one. Relationships, connections, this is where the real value comes in. And so these tools we have, whether it's the data itself or the altmetrics that we've heard Professor Sugimoto speak about, they're important to the extent that they make those things visible.
They are, and I think that there's a lot more work to be done to kind of call out the relationships. We are looking vigorously at ways to sort of mine our content and look at relationships. The challenge is to be able to get to predictive relationships as well. So it's not just understanding the individual data of an author to another author, or as Cassidy mentioned, really trying to be able to find relationships through mentoring, but it's also institution to institution. It's a geographic impact on institutions, government impact on institutions and the authors and the relationships between different geographic locations. It's all of the above, and being able to be predictive about that. So it's a big challenge. It's something we're very excited about at Wolters Kluwer.
Right, and to the point on reputation management, we speak of authors, we speak of researchers, but of course there's no uniformity in that group as well, and particularly in medicine, there's a contrast you see between the up-and-coming member of that community and the established.
Absolutely, and as we heard yesterday, there aren't even defined standards about what constitutes an author and who's actually doing the work and up and coming, and the reputation management is a tricky situation, I think, to Cassie's point about altmetrics. What we've seen is everybody's very interested in their own reputation, but they're not necessarily using metrics like altmetrics to sort of explore the landscape in their own community. Typically what we see is the community is very well defined by their specialty, and they researchers tend to know, or they think they know, and our hypothesis is that they're missing valuable connections in their own community, particularly in medicine, and particularly in research areas that are cross-disciplinary between one specialty and another.
Right, and Professor Sugimoto, when we talk about reputations, there are a lot of reputations at stake here, not just those of the authors and the researchers, as well as the publishers and many other parties. And I understand that your experience in joining the Future Lab Committee helped you to see that in a better way, that there's a kind of an oppositional view of those worlds. And from your experience in London, you saw something else.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, to put it crassly, I think the scholarly communication research community thinks of publishers as evil, right? They're trying to amass all these things to own our products, our intellectual products that we're creating. And it was fantastic being at Future Lab because I was expecting them to say, okay, how can we generate as much revenue from these scholars as possible? And the conversation was, how can we make data more accessible? How can we provide better metadata? How can we provide crosswalks? Right? So this conversation was really a positive one. But I want to take a second to go back to some of the things that we've been talking about here. Is there are these challenges of codification, and I think these are really important challenges, right? How do we make data usable? How do we make intelligible metadata? When does it become a scholarly object? Understanding disciplinary differences. But in some ways, that's the smaller challenge. The bigger challenge, as David alluded to, is the challenge of value. Because scholars' reputations are built on novelty, right? Being novel, being original. And so we've talked about replication here and negative results here, but the plain matter is you don't get credit for replicating. You don't get credit for negative results. So there is no value in those kinds of activities. So if we are trying to incentivize scholars to use this on the basis of reproducibility or negative results, that's going to be a conversation that's dead in the water. So we have to think about how that value can be communicated in other ways.
All right. And David Martson, on the subject of reputation management, in the discussion in London for the Future Lab Committee and to sort of reveal these trends for us, you looked at altmetrics and considered it before we even had a chance to hear from Professor Sugimoto today. And there's that altmetrics donut. And I heard you describe it that way. And I thought, well, my view of a donut is it's a lot of useless calories. might taste good going down, but we know it's going to be a while before we work it off. How do you see it that way? Is the donut, I mean, we're understanding right now that there's a lot of questions to be asked. Is it a useless calorie?
Well, I think, as one of the questioners asked, is it fair to judge it at this stage in its development? And I think researchers and agencies and publishers are all asked to kind of justify the value of their products and their outputs in the most favorable light. And in one sense, trying to improve my altmetric score to find the areas in which I can distinguish myself from the crowd is kind of like a Lake Wobegon effect, where everyone wants to be above average, and if I can find the particular axis on which I am better than the average researcher, then I will do that. And altmetrics, because it's measuring, potentially measuring a lot of different axes, gives me an opportunity to present myself in the most favorable light possible. There's also, I'd say, an early adopter effect. So if you are one of the people earlier on the altmetric bandwagon, that's a differentiator in itself. So once everybody's doing these alternative metrics and participating in them, then that early adopter advantage will go away and we'll be at a level playing field again.
Right. And Jerry Grenier, we heard Professor Sugimoto say that there's a real need for a diversity in all of our measurements, and it's a particularly complex scenario that she sketched out for us. But aren't we all looking for one grand score, one way to finally tally it all up and know for sure?
Right. I think that would be the ultimate holy grail is writing an algorithm that may be, you know, this long that ends up with a compute score that puts perspective to some of the altmetrics and maybe weights more heavily on the side of the traditional impact factor or JCR scores. But like anything else, we've talked about also a capability of uploading algorithms where one can then to a site and then adjust the parameters in the algorithm. So it opens itself up to gamesmanship either, I think, as well. So while the holy grail is to try to compute the score, the validity of any score, I think, will always be argued. We need to understand the unintended consequences of any score. When we look at, for example, the traditional impact factors, they were adopted in order to help librarians make buying decisions, and they over time turned into a measure, an individual measure, and that led to some negative behaviors on the part of some people, where they, you know, may begin to game citations, et cetera. So we need, I think, whatever measure we use, it's not so simple and cut and dry as a batting average in baseball, right? Well, we know a guy hitting 300 is going to get a hit 3 out of 10 times, and he's probably better than the guy hitting 200. I think attaching any score needs to have a lot of explanation around it, and it's not just a final end-all be-all.
Right. I'm thinking about, if we did have that algorithm you're imagining, Jerry, it would we could ask it the question, what is the answer to life, the universe, and everything? And, of course, 42 would be the perfect score. Jasper Simons, you have a point on this.
Yeah, I think there's it's a good discussion about what we want to measure to get to that final score. But I think one point is important for everyone, too, and if we all sort of try to engage with our communities and about providing services for our authors, and we all have a stake in building these metrics. And I think it's the actual how we measure it accurately is a very complicated matter in and of itself that I don't want to sort of put to the side. Even if we decide on what we want to measure to do it accurately, issues about name ambiguity are really profoundly impacting sort of how we can accurately measure what we're trying to measure. And I think that's sort of a different angle that I hadn't heard. I want to make sure that we take into consideration as well. And I think that's only going to get a stronger need for that as more decisions are being based on how people perform in their industry. So getting it right is essential.
Yeah, I'd add to that, too. I think maybe a metric that we haven't talked about is what has the author given back to the world to enable them to reproduce his or her results, right? And maybe that's a new score or a badge that we should apply to a paper that says this we not only published this paper, but this author has made available, you know, all of the artifacts and all of the necessary data, all the data necessary to reproduce the results that are being reported in this paper. And that might be a new score. There may be an RR, a reproducibility of results score. And I think it would be a pretty important metric, because at the end of the day, right, at the end of the day, science is all about is coming up with a theory or a result that someone else can replicate to say, yes, this is true, and simply giving a score to an author who gives back to the world all the necessary components to prove that out, I think would be a positive way forward for the industry.
Right. Well my metric as a moderator is to watch the time, and we have, I guess, about 3 or 4 minutes left for questions from the audience. So if you do have a question for our panel, I'll come over to you. Tell us who you are and who the question is for, please.
Glenn Collins from Origin Editorial. I think the question really is for everyone, and I think what journals are looking for is an OPS, not a batting average anymore, but an on-base percentage, everything else. How often do you actually get on base? That's my little baseball thing. But one thing that was not mentioned by the panel for the most part is advertising and how that is driving so much of this and the dollars. So you made the great point, Dr. Sugimoto, about how nobody is going to get credit for reproducing on their tenure track. But you said that's dead in the water. Why? And I know why. I know very well the answer. But I think it can't be dead in the water. Mm-hmm. Journals and publishing has changed so much in 10 years. Our advertising is going south for many of them. The traditional models are going south. All of the stuff that you're talking about, open access, it really threatens the journal itself, the branding. The article itself will just become important. The journal won't be so much. You can't make money off of that the same way. It's really threatening. But why is the institution still so protected about how they change, how they promote people? An RR score, that sounds great. Hmm. Can you get promoted for helping that score? Right now, not really, but maybe you should.
Mm-hmm. So. No, that, that's a great question. And I think we like to think of the ivory tower as immune from these issues of revenues and budgets, but we're not, right? And so people are also thinking about the institution's reputation, the institution's ability to get federal funding, right? And you get that from novelty, from novel results. I love this idea, and I love anything that would incentivize these kinds of reproducibilities. I do want to take a sentence here to talk about good citizenship, though. And we've been talking about these complex algorithms. And in many ways, altmetric.com is a fantastic good citizen of this. They've also, they're sensitive to weighting of different things. They know that a New York Times article isn't the same as a single tweet. And so I think it's important to know that the people working in Altmetrics right now are thinking about those kinds of issues. They also, their score is represented in a donut, so I don't know what that says, and goes back to the donut metaphor.
Okay, you have a question. And who's it for?
Hi, I'm Christine Orme with Ringgold, and as our Delphic oracles, I wanted to just ask you, is there a trend, or is there something that you would like to see as a trend? Is there something that you feel you are surprised has not yet been addressed in a robust way, or even addressed at all by the industry?
With all this covered on that chart, did we leave something out? Is that what you're asking?
On a personal level, just, you know, from your own experiences, like, wow, this is kind of my personal baby. I can't believe we're not talking about this.
Well, it's a fair point, because the method that was used in the Future Labs Committee ultimately sorts things out, and not everything gets in. A lot does, but not everything does. So, fair question. Did anybody feel something didn't get in?
I'd like to comment on that, and it follows on a little bit from what Cassidy said in her talk about this Truthy site from Indiana. And so in some sense, we're talking about things that really impact the way people survive in the research ecosystem. And because things can are so much... Well, first of all, one of the things that researchers are asked to do is to present their impact on society at large beyond the scholarly community. And so the Truthy Project, there was one, if you go and do a search on shrimp on a treadmill, there's these things where people have attempted to reach out to society at large that have gone bad because of political agendas out there. And so question one that raises in my mind is the availability of these social media things that go viral in a negative way having an impact on what researchers do as science, what they feel comfortable doing as science? And then with the whole idea of reputation management, are the skill sets that are necessary to make it in this social media world the same skill sets that are needed to do great research? And is there kind of unintended side effects because of the way that we're changing the focus of things? And maybe that's just part of the evolutionary process and it'll all get sorted out in the end. But in the short term, there may be some interesting side effects that we haven't anticipated.
Well, with that, I'm going to need to end our discussion here. You know, it's election season in the UK. It's always election season here in Washington, D.C. And when it comes to a discussion like this, I think of a view of a campaign that Lyndon Baines Johnson gave once. He said, "We are for a great many things and against damn few." I think that's pretty clear when it comes to the future. For a great many things, against damn few. I want to thank our panel, Jasper Simons, Jennifer Robinson, David Martinson, Jerry Grenier, and of course, Professor Cassidy Sugimoto. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you.